Om Shanti, good morning. So, a warm welcome to Brother Roger. Thank you for making yourself available and sharing with us this morning. I think the topic of compassion and empathy is something we don't often talk about. But as we moving towards becoming angelic, I think it's a quality that we definitely need to deeply inculcate within ourselves. So we look forward to what you can share with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Shanti. Good morning. A few years ago, probably shortly after Brahmin Life in 1996, I think I came first of all in 1992. My name is Roger Cole. And I've worked in the last 30 years in palliative care, end-of-life care, so looking after people in the probably progressive and advanced phases of illness as a doctor, and particularly focused on the terminal phase when people are in the sort of process of dying, leaving the body, whatever we want to call it. Thank you. Can everybody hear me okay? So, and one of the things that I started to recognize was in my life of spirituality, which started in about 1984, so 70, probably about 6 or 7 years before I came across the Brahma Kumaris, or the Brahma Kumaris came across me, or I don't quite remember how it was I got kidnapped and brought to Mount Abu, but it happened somewhere along the way. At some point I started to recognize the meditation practices of dying alive to a place of very pure acceptance, which wasn't limited but became unlimited, was very similar to the dying process that people go away in the more limited world, I suppose. But when people get everything forcefully taken away from them in terms of identity, when you lose energy, strength, and the ability to do the things that have defined yourself in the roles that you play in, and everything gets taken away from you, there's not much left to hold on to. And the state of acceptance and peace that I was seeing in some patients, the best cases, okay, the best case scenarios, particularly when I recognize that something I did made a difference and facilitated the process for people, or at least enabled it to accelerate towards that acceptance where there's total peace, not holding on to anything, there's no fear, there's complete sense of a power of pure love in the atmosphere. These aren't meditators, okay? These are actually people who have actually had to die from the world that they've lived in, had to die from the roles that they've played, had to go through suffering and distress of coming to terms with the fact that their disease is affecting them significantly. And so I started to look at my best cases, and I put them all together in a little book called Mission of Love, which I originally wrote the manuscript for that in 1996. It was eventually published about three kind of revisions later in 1999. And in that process, I wrote about 160 words, and the book has 160,000 words, and the book has about 47,000 words in it. So the editor taught me to be more essenceful along the way. And it also taught me how to write. And it also taught me a bit about how to communicate. One of the things that I recognized in this was, so that book actually has the best cases, and each of those cases where I share the patient's history with you is something to do with acceptance. It's something to do with the process that we try to connect with when we're going through dying alive in the meditation framework, yoga with Baba, becoming bodiless, letting go of the body. We're doing this through our effort, and we're doing this through the wisdom that Baba gives us. We're doing this through knowledge, and we're doing this through the practice of yoga, of union with with God, where we recreate within the self, or we reawaken our original sanskars, and we become the original nature of the soul. And the interesting thing is that there's no language for it. If you look at the 36 virtues that are taught in Raja Yoga, the words empathy and compassion, even caring, are not on the list. So they're not actually part of the original virtues. Obviously, there are qualities that make up these things: empathy, compassion. They're love and kindness based virtues, and compassion doesn't exist without empathy. And these are two ends of the framework of relationship with suffering, with the suffering of others to some extent, but with suffering in general. In a limited way, the suffering of others; in an unlimited way, the suffering of the world. And I was thinking today, you know, that what can I tell, or what can I say to a group of the most empathic and compassionate souls in the world? What can I say to them about empathy and compassion that they don't already know? And the answer is absolutely nothing. So I thought I'd have a conversation and share some of my experiences with you. Because I actually know that there's a depth of compassion within every soul here that comes from a depth of love. Whereas in the world, the limited world of compassion and empathy, and I'll talk to you a bit more about this. I'm not going to be here giving you lots and lots of kind of concepts and 20 points about the word compassion or anything like that. I want to actually convey the feelings of relationships with others that I've had in perhaps my patient-centered care that's out there in the world. But in the world, empathy and compassion has a foundation in sorrow. It doesn't exist in the original world, but in our world, when we separate ourselves from the world of sorrow, we start to create empathy and compassion from a place of love. And it's not once we step away from the world of sorrow into a place of love and kindness, we're actually starting to create a more unlimited vision of what compassion can be and what compassion can create, and what the value and the importance of empathy as part of the compassion process is. Because once we go from sorrow foundation to love foundation, we're actually transforming the nature of compassion from the way the world operates. Instead of it being empathy based in a special relationship with suffering, this is ego's basis for empathy, is a special relationship with suffering, a special relationship with love. This morning, I was choking on I was choking on my breakfast, and part of what I was choking on actually got stuck right over my airway, and I thought, oh, I better be careful about this, because this is actually nearly serious. So I separated myself from the breakfast group and went and sat down on my own to have my own little choke where no one could notice me. And I was being very careful about how I swallowed, and I was being very careful about how I breathed. It was all like concentrating on this airway thing. And the reason why I came to Madhaban this time actually was really my wife's here for the first time, Marie. She's a first timer, and it was to bring Marie here to meet Baba. But I've had the best experiences of my life here, this visit. But Marie joked. Marie works in palliative care, end of life care, as a nurse, and so someone said she should give more. Because she was joking about the topic today, someone said to her, "You should be more compassionate." And she said, "He's not dying." I'd be more compassionate if he was dying. And this is the way the world is. If you deserve compassion, you get it. If you don't, you don't get it. Okay. So we're very conditional in the way the ego has created its concepts about compassion. And it might be worth us just looking at that first of all, because it's something about undoing this whole aspect of trying to understand what is the depth of, where do we find the depth of love from which true compassion emerges, true empathy emerges? Where do we find that? And when I think about it, at this time in the confluence age, we're actually restoring the soul, the nature of the soul, back to its original nature. You know, and the original qualities of the soul: peace, power, purity, love, and bliss. These are the qualities in which we attain our angelic stage. They're the qualities with which we return back home with Baba to Paramdham. And after that, there are two separations that take place. And the world of today is a world based on separation. Ego's world is a separation world. And the first separation is from God and Paramdham. We come down as the Golden Age, where there's no duality of terms. There's no love and hate. There's no happiness and sorrow. There's no language for anything other than love, happiness, purity, bliss. There's no language even for those things because they just are. There's not even a language for happiness because it just is. There's nothing else to compare it to. So there's no language actually. And my feeling is that the soul consciousness of the Golden Age is very innocent. There's an innocence about the soul consciousness. It's not that I come down knowing I'm a soul in the body. It's actually I just come as a little being. When you see a baby born or something new, a baby born to begin with is innocent, and it doesn't actually lie there thinking I'm a soul. It's actually just being. So we come here and there's a beautiful innocence of our nature and being and relationship with each other and with nature, and we become beautiful creators without really any consciousness that I'm a soul. We're totally unconscious of the relationship we had with God in this birth now. And truly at that time, ignorance was bliss. We lived in blissful ignorance. But fast forwarding a little bit, the next separation that took place, and there's no language for caring, no language for compassion, no language for empathy. There was none of that. There was no language for anything like that. It was just a beautiful kind of paradise of perfect relationship. This is my feeling about it. It might be my man math, but it's my feeling about it. I'm not sure about all the kind of, but it's beautiful relationship. It was still innocent, beautiful relationship. The next separation that takes place is separation from my original nature. So the original nature and qualities that I brought that keeps the Golden Age and Silver Age functioning so beautifully, I separate from at the beginning of the Copper Age. And this is now a more significant separation, because it's a separation in which I feel my individuality. I become an individual and duality takes place on the world stage. So the ego is born, sense of the body consciousness, the sense of self separated from others, separated from my original nature. So the separated self starts to project a different type of world, and that separation becomes more and more difficult as we go along, because now there's a duality and happiness is experienced in association with the potential for sorrow, love and hate. You know, these separated, the two sides start to emerge that weren't there before. There's now a language for happiness and love and kindness and generosity and warmth and all of those things, because there's now a language for the opposite of all of those things as well. So we go into a world in which we can experience sorrow, and suffering starts to take place in that world. Ego, separation, body consciousness, projection of a sense of separation on others, and we all do it to each other. So collectively we create this new projected world of the ego, my sense of self separated, selfless service becomes selfish. Even I start to use my best qualities to get something. I can remember when my son was really young, you know, he'd been through that very innocent phase. And he had a very beautiful quality of innocence, actually. He kind of like had the most innocent face and the most innocent eyes when he looked up at me, said daddy, and all those sort of beautiful things. And then he found a few things that he liked. And then he started to actually realize he could use his innocence to get what he liked. It was incredibly sweet. We give through our virtues. Even at that time, we're giving through our virtues, but we're also getting through our virtues. And the very subtlety of the beginning of vices is not actually vices. They're actually using the virtues to get something. It's like a selfish aspect over the virtues and qualities. It's later that when it becomes more tamo pradhan, then it becomes more vices, where I'm very attached to getting, and I'm using everything to get. Even the goodness that I have, I'm getting something from it. But suffering emerges on this stage, because karma starts to become, we start to collect the accounts of our karma. And one of the responses to suffering on the world stage then is through the ego. Through the ego's, it's created all this a complex world, a world that's in which we get more and more tangled up together until we become like, I know perhaps not everyone here does Christmas, but you know when you get these little lights that you put on the flash beautifully on your tree and you can put them all over, you know, your deck, the deck or over the house, and they hang down, they all flash beautifully. But when you take them out next year, you can't undo them because they're like a big ball that's all stuck together, and you're trying to tangle them. You just go and buy some new ones because it's too much trouble. But you know, we tangle up our karma and our accounts tangle up as we go along, and suffering emerges through this body consciousness and ego. Suffering arises. Now, the ego, we would never use the ego if we thought we were bad. Okay? It's not like the ego becomes the self. It's like the self starts to utilize the only identity it knows, which is through the ego this time. And the ego would have no hold over me if I thought it was bad. So the ego tries to do good things. And one of the good things it does is it creates a response to suffering in the world outside, which can be called empathy and compassion. Now, these are good, beautiful things, but they're actually an expansion of the problem I've created, which is suffering. So the solution is actually an expansion of the problem in a way. So the empathy and compassion that happens on the world stage today could be seen not necessarily as a solution, but a part of suffering and distress. It's connected to suffering and distress. It's limited because one of the thoughts I've had about the difference between love, you know, love, unconditional love, pure love, is that unconditional pure love is like a thread of oneness amongst us. It's what we shared in the golden age without knowing what it was. It's what we can share sometimes when we're in really the most perfect and beautiful relationships to each other. It's what you can actually sometimes experience with someone who's suffering when you're practicing an empathic way and you're being compassionate. There's like a feeling of togetherness or union or a dissolving away of space between you. But the love of the world stage today is actually the love of special relationships. So it's the same thing. It's separation, special relationship. Even suffering, special relationship. And this is like the subtlety of the beginning of lust, is the early subtleties of lust is to create special love relationships. And that can be from with myself and my child. You know, I give unconditional love to my child. So my child receives unconditional love to me. But I'm withholding love from somewhere else. So the condition of my unconditional love is this is my child. So I create this special relationship, and when we have this unconditional love that's not inclusive but is exclusive for the beautiful being that I recognize as belonging to me, I'm withholding love at the same time as giving it. So it's no wonder I'm confused about what life is and what love is. And this aspect of special relationships is very much part of empathy and compassion. But we can take it from the limited to the unlimited when we have knowledge. And I want to go into what it is, first of all, or how to relate to it. Empathy is both are forms of love and kindness. On one side is the attention that we give to someone. When we give attention with love and kindness to someone, that's empathy. When we act with love and kindness in relationship to what we've understood about someone from the empathy side of it, when we act with love and kindness appropriately to the needs of somebody, that's compassion. So the attention that's given is like a deep connection to the feelings and the sense of the vibration, the body language that someone has, what they have to say, how they're feeling. And in my context, of course, with people who are terminally ill or facing deaths in the near future, they may be suffering from various different things, for various different reasons, mentally, physically, emotionally, socially with family networks, existentially and spiritually. You know, the dimensions through which we experience life are the dimensions through which suffering enters life. And I need to be sensitive to the feelings of people that I'm with, because I don't know that my solutions are going to fix their problems. So they don't need me to be the embodiment of solutions. They first of all need my attention to get a feel for who they are, and my lightness perhaps in relationship to them, because I'm a palliative care doctor, and that's not always the doctor you want to see coming through your doorway or next to your bedside, because it's pretty scary stuff for people. So the attention, where attention goes, energy flows. If I give quality attention to people, I can pick up the feelings that they have. I can sense whether they look comfortable and relaxed in the moment, or if they look somewhat low and depressed or unhappy, or if they're just kind of turned away from the world and have that kind of harsh kind of don't enter my space sort of look, feeling to them, and I'm going to adjust myself to each person individually. You know, I learned this because when I was training as an oncologist or a cancer specialist in my early years, I had a wake-up moment in my life when I thought, I know nothing of the suffering of people with cancer, and I'm almost trained to treat them with chemotherapy. And at that point, I decided I need to understand the suffering better. So I went to the bedside and I talked to people and I asked them what it was like to be diagnosed with cancer. How does it feel to live with this disease? How does it feel to go through the treatments that we give you? What's it like for you? What was it like when the cancer came back, when you thought it had all been successfully treated a year ago? And I got the responses from them. I listened to everything they had to say. And all I was trying to do was learning about their experience. I wanted to know what their experience was, not just treat it, the disease. I wanted to know what they were experiencing. And the amazing thing that happened for me at that point, okay, and I did this over and over and over again with people for maybe a couple of years. But what happened at that point was that patients started to tell other people, and nursing staff and people around, that it had been a wonderful experience to speak to me. And yet I wasn't doing anything. And I started to think, wow, what is all that about? There was kind of a healing process taking place that had nothing to do with me doing anything for them, because I wasn't even trying to counsel, or I wasn't trying to be empathic. I didn't know what empathy was, to be honest with you. I was trying to just understand what was their experience, and in that was healing. Healing was taking place. And this was a wake-up call for me. It's like a, okay, there's something beautiful about healing that's to do with connecting to the stories people have of what they've been going through and what their life is. And then my attention got much more clear, because I talked to so many different people from so many different backgrounds with so many different personalities that I started to find myself able to adjust to just about everybody. You know, and I found it just took me less and less time to make that adjustment. The quality of your attention and the capacity to adjust and accommodate the personalities of others and then to listen to their stories is huge in terms of the empathy side of compassion. And I always say these days, I always warn a little bit about don't just go along as the embodiment of solutions. Because it rains books. Someone gets cancer, it rains books. And it rains advice. It rains complementary therapies. It doesn't stop. It just keeps on coming from all directions. And it's already raining what treatments the doctors are offering. So someone with a disease and illness or deteriorating health is under a barrage of ideas at times. And they may appreciate it okay, and they may appreciate the solution. But what you're doing when you're offering solutions before you give an attention to the person is you're avoiding their sorrow. You're avoiding their suffering. You're avoiding their loss. You're avoiding their fear because you're solving it before you're understanding it. And so you might be lucky and get a bullseye with what you've offered. But you'll get far more clearer bullseyes if you actually sit down and feel and start to explore the helplessness and the content of suffering that the person has, their helplessness, their fear perhaps. Don't think they're different from normal though, but don't go in with this concept that this person is in fear and distress and anxiety about their disease and they want to talk all about it. Because they may not be. They may be just living on a day-to-day basis feeling completely normal. Completely normal. I'm a normal person. Even a very sick person who's lost the ability to do everything, has become weak and bedbound and dependent, you might take in this idea of how terrible that is and how frustrating that must be for the person. And acknowledge, I often do that, and I might acknowledge the frustration and angst of it, and they'll say it is, but then there's a other side to that. When I'm lying down here in bed, I feel completely normal. And so what I'm telling you is I'm a normal human being. I'm just being who I am. I'm still quite capable of humor and having a laugh, enjoying the lightness. Just be natural with me. Don't be unnatural. Don't be unnatural because you've got within you all these feelings about what suffering and distress is and what it must be like to die, because that probably does exist in them at the same time as that, but that's not where they are at that moment. See, you need to sit down with them, not where they are, very comfortable with yourself, and to allow them to and to accept them where they are and to meet them where they are. Because on the other side of extreme dependency is the person may be lying there feeling normal, but they can't do anything they used to be able to do in all the roles that they used to play. They've lost their identity. The disease and illness that's progressive has been an identity crisis for them. Does that sound like dying alive? Are we in an identity crisis at any time as we die alive? This has been happening. They've lost identity. So it's been frustrating. I'm so angry this has happened to me. It's been frustrating. But then I surprise them. Do you ever feel really peaceful? And the surprising thing is, yes. Do you ever lie there feeling incredibly at peace with yourself? Yes, because when we lose all of our identities, when we die alive, we're in an incredible state of peace, aren't we? Incredible state of peace. So when someone's had all their identity taken away from them, they may not be frightened. They might be happier when they're in peace. And you can actually find that place of peace, talk about it. It can become a seed of good spiritual discussion sometimes. So quality of attention with love and kindness to find out where is the person at before offering solutions, please. Don't become an embodiment of solutions. Because I went to one of my teachers when I was young in palliative care or end-of-life care was Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. You may not remember or know of Elizabeth, but she wrote a book called On Death and Dying. And she had her day in the 70s and 80s. And she wrote her book about about the stages of dying, you know, denial, must be a mistake, it was someone else's results, it can't be mine. Anger, why me, why now? You know, how could this happen at such a time? I'm a good person. So and so up the road, he beats his wife and drinks and nothing happens to him. You know, bargaining, you know, trying, if I'll be good for the rest of my life, if you get rid of the bargaining with God, I'll always be good, I'll do the good thing, I'll do the right thing, or bargaining for time. I went to see a patient once in the ward and I said to the patient, what do you want for Christmas? What would you like for Christmas? Because it was Christmas time. And he said, Easter. Bargaining for time. Depression. You know, sometimes very deep depression, sometimes just so weak. It's not depressed, I'm just so weak. But ultimately acceptance, a state of pure, beautiful peace. And Kubler-Ross taught about two things in particular, and this is to do with empathy. I haven't even got on to compassion yet. One was about unfinished business. The second was about unconditional love. Unfinished business that's significant in this relationship with suffering on the world stage where ego has created suffering in terms of suffering and in terms of the empathizing with someone who's in a suffering situation is what will get in the way is my unfinished business. This will lead to avoidance, actually. Or this will lead to two things. It will lead to avoidance or becoming the embodiment of solutions before connecting to the suffering of the person that you're with. And this unfinished business is two things predominantly. One is the grief that we've accumulated in this birth in particular, but perhaps the sanskars of loss, separation, loss and grief that's happened in multiple births over time, leaves inside us a seed that can recognize distress in others and we feel uncomfortable and reactive to that, and we feel helpless. We don't know what to do or what to say. And really, sometimes it's good to stay with those feelings instead of trying to overcome them. But part of what we do in meditation, what we do with Baba's love, what we do in terms of self-awareness, is kind of a healing process, which is about enabling us to become more and more vulnerable to love. We fear vulnerability to love sometimes because of all the unfinished business that we have inside of us around sorrow, loss, grief, anger, victimization in childhood. All these things that we've built our defenses around, and to be honest with you, sometimes very harsh use of disciplines on ourselves is a defense against vulnerability. I've got a patient at the moment who's a lady who's a Buddhist. she's Buddhist practitioner, and she has put such discipline in her life, and incredibly disciplined practices around her meditation practices. But underneath it all is that she went through childhood abuse at a very heavy level. And she's whacked down her spiritual life now. She's created a spiritual life in which she's holding herself together with panic attacks. But the strength of her disciplines holds out the panic attacks. And the panic attacks is like, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder has this like panic attack in someone who can actually be a very strong personality, strong nature, powerful nature, ability to face things, but panic attacks, which looks like a weakness, but it's a mixed up state. She's suppressing all of this pain inside using disciplines of spiritual practice on herself. It's amazing, really, and she's using it in quite a powerful way. But vulnerability to love. The time when I experienced the most purest, well, obviously my most purest love has been here with Baba through Raj Yoga meditation, through this family of beautiful souls, the creative love that we share together. But my original experience of love was in a workshop with Kubler Ross, and it was in the context of letting go of grief. The workshop was like a supposedly a life-death transitional workshop. But it was actually an experiential workshop of letting go of loss from your life. It was a very cathartic getting out the feelings workshop, which we were beating these sort of telephone directories and screaming anger, or we were crying into a pillow. And the pillow was like a softness of remembering something that really hurt you or some loss from the past and going into it. And I went into a loss, incredible loss, where I grieved that loss, and I broke down and poured out this catharsis of tears. You know, I almost shrank the carpet that I was crying onto. And at the end of the experience, I had an emptiness, a real emptiness that was so remarkable. The emptiness became full. It just filled with peace. It filled with so much peace. It was like the peace just became such a pure experience that it felt as if I was becoming peaceful everywhere. And I felt a kind of liberation from everything, a freedom, and then waves of love, sort of liberation and love. And it became, those two things together became bliss. And I was in this bliss, still with the tears on my face. And what had happened was there was a key experience in this lifetime when I was a child that opened my heart and let me grieve outward. But it was like every sanskar of loss that was in my soul saw that door of my heart open, and it just leapt out onto the carpet with all my tears. And this is the moment when I was not a spiritual person. I didn't believe in God. I didn't believe in the soul. I was just having a good time at the time. But after that, I felt so much love. But I felt that love of, you were all there. Yeah. You were all there. You were all there. We were all together in my love. The separation was not there. The feeling of oneness, of unity, of love for everything, nature. And I thought, this is God. This is God. This is a bit of an aside now, but I was a registrar, a trainee in oncology, so chemotherapy of cancer, at a major teaching hospital in Sydney at the time. And I went back to the hospital. The five-day workshop finished. I went back to the hospital from this Kubler Ross workshop. and I felt I was in love with everybody and everything. I just walked on the floor. I was in love with all the patients. I was in love with all the doctors and the nurses and everything. I was in love with. I was in love with the flowers and the trees and the tarmac. I was just in love with everything. And when I got to the ward, I felt one of my supervisors was a doctor who I was in conflict with before the workshop. And when I saw him, I said, "I love you." He got the team psychiatrist to see me. And I had 12 months of personal supervision under this psychiatrist after coming back from the workshop, which was wonderful because he was a deeply Christian soul. And he recognized what was happening, and he recognized the spiritual opportunity that was going on for me. And he took me aside and offered me supervision like I was a psychiatry trainee. And I was able to kind of work through this experience with a psychiatrist every week for a year. And that supervision has helped me through the next 30 years of my medical practice. And I went from oncology to palliative care on the depth of wanting this more empathic relationship with people. I'm going to give you a couple of people that I've seen along the way, because I want to let you know, talk to you a little bit about compassion in a moment. But every single patient that I've written about or spoken about or I share in this sort of context is a particularly useful example. It's not every patient I see this happens to, okay? But every now and again there's someone who stands out, and every single one has a lesson that we could all take away in our own kind of practice of meditation, of dying alive. And there was a man that I saw this year, maybe it was the end of last year, but more recently than the sort of examples in Mission of Love. And he'd been an alcoholic, okay, and he'd developed alcoholic liver disease, and he was terminally ill on account of that. And he'd become, I think he'd also developed on the background of the alcoholic liver disease, a cancer in the liver, and his condition had deteriorated at home. He was a man who was living on his own. His children and family had nothing to do with him anymore. He had no friends. And he got to a point where he just fell over at home because he was too weak to walk anymore. And he was brought into hospital. There was nothing to do for him except, because he was just weak from his disease and he could no longer look after himself or support himself, and he didn't have any friends or any family or anybody that wanted to look after him. And who knows what was in his background? Who knows what happened through those years? Who knows how his relationships got destroyed? Who knows what he was carrying in terms of remorse or guilt or loss of family or anger or rejection of everybody? Who knows what was in his feelings and thoughts and mind? But I was asked to see him because he had nowhere to go. Yeah, and he was pretty well homeless. So we're going to have to look after him in hospital. And the only place we could look after him in the hospital, because he only had weeks to live maximum at the time when I saw him, the only place we could look after him in the hospital was in the palliative care unit. But I walked in to see him, and so attention. When you give attention to anybody, your qualities are in that attention. So when you're giving attention to anyone and it's good quality attention, it carries your qualities because it has your attitude and nature is in that attention. So even though you may not be soul conscious, you may be role conscious, the practice of soul consciousness is emerging beautiful qualities in you, and your attention will carry those qualities to others. That first of all, you're there giving attention, they're receiving your qualities. This happens, I learned this from nursing staff. I met some people along the way who were very difficult personalities, and then I observed them in relationship to a patient who was suffering, and I thought, what a beautiful nurse. What a beautiful nurse. And I stopped judging people. You know, it's just such a beautiful contact and connections made. And it's the attention that's in compassion. It's connecting the best of you to the other person. That empathy, compassion, the best of you with the attention is being connected to the other person without you knowing about it. Because you're just being who you are. And you can only be who you are. And so trust that what you have is being given at the time when you're giving attention, because sometimes you would be helpless for what the answer is. And that's another thing. But the first thing I noticed about this man was he didn't want anyone near him. He didn't want me anywhere near him. He was rejective. His body language was rejective. He was turned away from the world. He was almost fetal positioned out of this world. I want nothing to do with anybody. I hate everybody. I hate the world. I hate what's happening to me. I hate my loss of independence. I hate myself. And how to get through that was really like, how do I respect that and get through that? So I respected it, first of all, and I stayed in role. I stayed in my role. And so I was very task orientated. I didn't want communication, didn't want me to talk to him, didn't want anything to do with me. He wanted me to go away. That was the only thing that he wanted. So I just told him what I had to tell him. Listen, I'm Dr. Roger Cole. I'm from the Palliative Care Service. You're not well enough to go home. You're very sick. And he's sort of like, go away, go away, go away. He's not saying that, but his language is saying that. Yeah, shut up and go away. This is all it was. Had the curtains drawn. This is all, And I said, well, so I just kept practical. We're going to have to transfer you to the palliative care hospital, and we'll look at where we'll take care of you. You're very sick at the moment. And with that, I turned to walk away, because there was nothing else I could do. The curtains were drawn okay, and sometimes you can be more creative in palliative care than some other areas of medicine. The curtains around the bed were drawn. And as I got to the curtain and I was going to leave, I just thought to myself, what a terrible way to die. And then I thought, there's absolutely nothing to lose here. So I turned around, I walked to him, I put a hand over his heart center on his chest, and I said to him, I am so, so sorry. You are so sick. It's the cancer in the liver that's been catching up with you. You're not going to live for very much longer. And we're going to take care of you like a brother and a friend. And he put one hand, then the other hand over my hand. And his tears welled up in his eyes. I left it there at that point, and he was waiting transfer to the other hospital, but for 2 days he came under my care, and I saw him 2 days later, and I walked back in, I walked towards him, and he was quite open and welcoming. His body language was totally different, and he smiled. He was very weak. You could barely hear him talk. You had to lean forwards to hear him talk, and he was talking in almost a whisper. And I said to him, you seem different. And he said, yes. He said, after you were talking to me about palliative care, I started to think. And I was thinking and thinking. And then I just realized something. And I'm trying to hear what he's saying, you know. And I said, well, what was that? He said, well, I was thinking about all my problems. And then I realized, nothing matters. Nothing matters. And I said, your problems don't matter? He said, no, your problems have gone away, I said. He said, no, my problems are still there, but they don't matter. And it was like all the pain and distress and sorrow that he might have created for others, all the pain and distress and sorrow that he had for himself, were gone. And they were gone in one moment, or maybe in one or two moments. But the first moment was, we will treat you as a friend and a brother. The belonging to somewhere happened for him. Coming home to somewhere happened for him. And then he just had let go of his past when I saw him the next time. And he was quite at peace with dying. Quite able, and quite contented, actually. So he'd gone from this incredible, angry, distressed, distraught, no one get near me, to happy to receive care. Vulnerable, open, rather than closed up like a shell that's destroyed. So, in that case, I gave attention to him and I acted according to his nature, but then I took a risk. I went into his space, and anything could happen in going into his space, because he could have just been more angry and upset. But I did it with as good a heart as I could do, and I took the risk because what was there to lose? There was nothing to lose there. It wasn't really being a doctor. It was just being a human being at the bedside. I can remember another lady, because there was letting go, wasn't it? He'd let go and nothing matters. And we should remember that. Nothing matters, actually. Don't beat yourself up too much. Have some empathy and compassion for yourself if you want to have empathy and compassion for others. Start to really give attention to loving yourself in a way, and being kind to yourself in a way. Even if others aren't being kind to you, be kind to yourself and be loving towards yourself, because you've made it here, for heaven's sake. And sometimes we don't know how to even heal ourselves or to let go of things. I had a lady who I saw years ago, and she's written Intermission of Love as one of the case studies that I used there. And she was a lady who was a really high achiever academically, but an incredibly high achiever business-wise and in local government. A very successful philanthropic lady who was very generous-hearted and had done a lot for the local community. It's a total success story she was. And she had a couple of children who had grown up. She was in her 50s and had advanced breast cancer with secondary spread of cancer to multiple organs of the body, who became progressively unwell in the last kind of months of her life. And she came under my care in hospice, so in a palliative care hospital unit, in a end-of-life care place that we have in some of our Australian hospitals and the like. And when I visited her one day and talked to her by name, and then she looked up at me, and she looked kind of a bit distressed or a bit wanting, needing something. And she pleaded with me. She said, "Please, Dr. Cole," actually she called me Roger, but Dr. Cole sounds much more official. Please, Dr. Cole, how do I let go? I've read all of your books. I've done everything you said, and I can't do it. So I'm looking at her, and she's looking at me. I'm sitting at the bedside, and I'm looking at her, and she's looking at me. And I'm feeling a bit helpless and a bit inadequate, because she's read all my books, she's done everything I said, and it hasn't worked for her, and I haven't got anything else to say, because I've already written it all into my books. So I'm sitting there, and sometimes if you can hold a helpless moment, you can open the universe of opportunity. So instead of rushing in with all the things I've already said that didn't work for her, I sat with her quietly, holding her hand quietly, not knowing what to say quietly, as comfortably helpless as I could be, yet feeling very inadequate to provide an answer to her. But in that moment, I remembered everything about her, every single detail of her nature and personality, and how she'd lived her life entered my mind in that moment. And in that moment, I had a realization. She's trying to do dying well. She wants a PhD in death and dying. And in that realization, the answer came to me. And the answer, when you create a space which is empathy, sometimes into that space, rather than trying to fix and solve things, into that space comes a gift that's not just for the person you're with, it's for you as well. We both got a gift. And the gift was this. There is absolutely nothing you have to do. And she said, thank God for that. And at that moment, she was free. She let go. There's nothing you have to let go of. Absolutely nothing. You've been an amazing person all your life. You've done so much for your community. You've prepared your children for your dying. You've been open about what's going on. And you've outlived the expectations of everyone about how long you could manage to live with this disease. You've been absolutely amazing. So there's a little word after let go, which you need to take away. And that little word is the word of. There is nothing to let go of. Acceptance is not of dying. It's not of the suffering. It's not of the distress. It's acceptance. Letting go is not of the past. It's not of what happened. It's letting go because nothing matters. Once you take away these details, suddenly we realize that when I'm dying alive, I'm in a state of acceptance of this moment. And if you want to use letting go in a very productive and creative way, perhaps, if you want to let go of something, let go of the future. If you have to use the of word, use it for one thing, the future. Because if you let go of the future, it automatically contains letting go of the past, because you're not bringing the past into the future. You're not bringing your past sanskars into the future. You're not bringing your past sanskars into the present. You're in a state of acceptance and you've let go. So now you're allowing everything to be the way it is. You're not struggling with the drama. You're not in a state of resistance to what's happening. You're free, actually. And this is where the compassion side, the action according to the needs that the empathy is informing you with, the quality of attention, the love and kindness and the quality of your attention then merges into the quality of your action. The love and kindness in the quality of your action. And some traffic control.
सतयुग में तुमको आ शक्ति सेना की रणभेरी